You found it. The best place for live, local, conservative talk in the morning. The Commute with Carlson. Stimulating, entertaining, and making a difference. Here's John Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
Okay, the great thing about doing your own talk show is you can call an audible at the last minute and just kind of move everything to the side, but only for a moment. This settlement between men's and women's soccer that will result in women being the paid the same as male soccer players. And this has been an obsession of Megan Rapinoe's for a long time. Here's the question that I have, and I think it's a very reasonable question. Does women's soccer generate as much revenue as men's soccer? I don't know the answer to that question. I am guessing, again, guessing the answer is no, because the PGA Tour, the women's golf tour, generates less money than the men's tour. The WNBA generates less money than the NBA. Now, couldn't Sue Bird of the Seattle Storm, couldn't she make the exact same argument as her wife, Megan Rapinoe, is making when it comes to we put in the time at practice, we get out there and hustle just like the men do, we do the same job the men do, we deserve the same pay? So why should women's soccer players get the same amount of money as male soccer players if their league doesn't generate as much money?
Yeah. And this is going to revolve around...
That's what this is all about, is money.
Yeah, this is going to revolve around the pool of money for international play, not necessarily for a league, because this applies to the U.S. men's and U.S. women's national teams, World Cup type competition. But it just, as you were going through that explanation, I thought, okay, what if high school students put on a quote-unquote musical Broadway type play? Do they deserve the same pay as the performers in New York City on Broadway? Hey, they're putting on a play.
More to the point.
They're putting on a play.
Do off-Broadway plays?
Mm. Yeah.
Do the performers, you know, everyone from the stage crew to the director to the actors,
you bet,
do they get the same amount of money for an off-Broadway play as Broadway actors?
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing no.
Yeah, I mean, they're putting on a play, right?
And so... Again, this is one of the things about our society that is so annoying because it's so unnecessarily divisive. And that is, they're making this about sexism.
Yeah.
It's not about sexism. If women were doing better than men and generating more money than men, then they would be getting more money.
Yeah. I mean, KVI has a couple of female talk show hosts, Dana Lash and Crosby, Reed Crosby, who's on in the evening.
Yeah.
And would a female talk show host in Boulder, Colorado get the same amount of pay as these female show hosts who have their shows syndicated on stations across the country? This would seem to say that they should. But in reality, we know that makes zero sense.
So I come back to the main point. Why are we allowing someone to make an economic issue a gender issue? It's not a gender issue. It's a revenue issue. It's a money issue. It's like saying that a rap artist or a rock star should not be paid any more than a jazz singer. Because the jazz singer works hard too. The jazz singer's just as devoted to his or her craft as the rock star or the rap artist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fine. But it's all about box office.
You bet. You do a performance that's 90 minutes long, both the jazz artist and the pop artist. Both do concerts of the same length. Perhaps they release a CD. Both have 12 tracks or 10 track song recordings. So it's all the same, right?
Just pay 11 the same, minutes huh? into the show, and already I'm making profound societal observations. Okay, by the way, big news, scary news. You remember, this is an update that in the back of my mind I thought was always a likelihood, but I didn't want to speculate. Do you remember when that Boeing 737-800 was flying at like 29,000 feet and then it just nosedived into a mountain range in China earlier this year?
Oh, gosh, yeah, just a couple months ago.
There is a report just out, Wall Street Journal, that flight data from the plane's black box, which they found, quote, indicates someone in the cockpit intentionally crashed the China Eastern Airlines plane into the jungle.
Wow.
They believe it was someone in the cockpit committing suicide.
That was,
obviously would be the pilot. And, of course, that would be murder suicide.
So, John, we had 132 on board. That was the Kunming to Guangzhou flight on March 21st. And I just got an update. I was going to share it here at the bottom of the hour. They're not clear if it was a pilot or, like you said, somebody broke into the cockpit. They're still looking into the matter. But, wow.
The plane, again, had been cruising at 29,000 feet and then just inexplicably nosedived. Now, there has been video of the plane nosediving, and you don't see it, for instance, on fire. So it's not like catastrophic failure or terrorism. You know, let's say somebody had, you know, detonated a bomb. The plane was intact, and it was just, again, dropping nose first at a hideous rate, 29,000 feet in 1 minute. Boom. So that is what they now believe is the likely explanation. And you will remember that, alluding to what Mark is suggesting, that the flight data may have depicted a battle for control of the plane, because remember, the plane was nosediving, went down 20,000 feet from its 29,000 foot altitude, then it started to level out, and then a second nosedive. So if you hadn't heard that information yet, that is what they believe, that this was not a mechanical failure, and it was not human error. They believe it was crashed.
John, what were you saying on the time of the elevation going nosedive to the crash itself? Did you say like a minute?
Yes, it had been cruising 29,000 feet, and in less than a minute, it fell more than 20,000 feet.
Okay, so tomorrow if you see Mount Rainier, put two Mount Rainiers on top of each other. Wow, that is a fall.
No, exactly. Anyway, wanted you to know about that here on the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. A lot of stuff going on nationally and locally. Speaking of mountains, you know what this is the anniversary of, don't you, radio legend?
Of course. I've got stories.
Mount St. Helens exploded 42 years ago today. We might take calls from people. We get the most fascinating recollections of people.
Yeah.
All these years later.
Always been upset because I had a heck of a job offer in radio in Yakima. On this very day in 1980, a Sunday morning, I'm packing the van, ready to go to the job. Suddenly, I turn on Como TV. Eruption of Mount St. Helens. I never got the job. They canceled the offer. My whole world path of radio changed, and I had to figure out where I was going.
What, they blame you for blowing up the mountain?
You couldn't get to Yakima. And when it took me 4 days to finally get a call to the station in Yakima. I said, Mark, we just eliminated your job. You can't even get over here. There's too much ash. So we're just going to work through it. And, you know, we're trying to figure it out. But I bought my first masks and pantyhose for the first time. And some of the ladies up at Como TV and the weather department, like Kristen Clark, what are you talking about? You had to have the mask because you couldn't breathe the ash, because I eventually did go to Spokane. And you needed the pantyhose because all mechanics were saying you got to put it over the air intake of your engine. Otherwise, if the ash gets in your engine, it's going to damage it.
Yep. 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 No, that's... That I remember that advice being given. I remember that advice being given. But just, you know, the car would choke on the thick ash that was hovering for so long.
From my window to the streets below, on a freshly fallen silent shroud of snow, I am a rock.
Connected like a DC lobbyist, it's time for the social media suite on The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI.
I built walls.
I think Paul Simon wrote this song when he was in a very bad mood. Either that or just had a breakup or something. Wow. I'm a rock. Of course, that was during the years of Simon and Garfunkel. Remember, if there's a song you like from the 60s, we play hits from the 60s coming back from commercial breaks during the 6 o'clock hour. So let me know. Just email me, john@kvi.com. Tell me what you want to hear, and we'll try and make it happen for you. That's john@kvi.com. We've gotten thousands of requests, and we've done a really good job, thanks to Mark Christopher, of making sure we have slotted every one of them. All right, Philip J. Vandervoort III at 23 minutes after 6. What's going on in the social media world?
I know you're going to have a guest coming up at the bottom of the hour related to some of the primary election results from yesterday. And
yes,
I am looking at a post on social media from an NBC News MSNBC correspondent, a woman named Blaine Alexander, about what is record-breaking turnout in the state of Georgia. And this after President Joe Biden described their recent election reform, election integrity, election security, ballot security law as Jim Crow on steroids.
Well, no, because Jim Crow held down the vote. So you must have some incorrect information here. How could they be having a great turnout if they had just had Jim Crow 2.0.
Yeah. Let me tell you what the MSNBC reporter has posted.
Okay.
Here's the post. Georgia has seen record-breaking turnout for early voting. Latest numbers from the Secretary of State's office. 422,500 in-person ballots cast. That's nearly 200% higher than at this time in 2018 and 150% higher than this point in 2020. And the early voting will end this Friday in Georgia. So, apparently this voter suppression stuff that all the Democrats were complaining about with Georgia's law
doesn't seem to be suppressing.
It's not happened.
Well, by the way,
figure.
You know what it does? It also validates and vindicates the Republicans' voter security laws.
Okay.
Because that's what they said would happen. They said, we'll actually have more opportunities for people to vote, but we're going to make it tougher to cheat.
Boom. There you go.
And it turns out the numbers don't lie, do they?
Mm-hmm.
Numbers don't lie.
Legal scholar Jonathan Turley, we talk about from time to time on the social media suite because he's always mm-hmm. posting something incredibly helpful with great perspective. He has come across a very candid column in the Washington Post about schools that are switching away from the letter grading of students, in part because, well, We might have some students that fail. And the whole idea of, well, you know, it's probably racist to give letter grades out and whatever other the excuses are for that grading system that we've kind of come to know for the most part. So Jonathan Turley points out that the complaint is that reliance on grades is demotivating for low-performing students, according to the activists that want to change this and that want to move away from that. And he writes, objecting to grades as demotivating for students is like objecting to stopwatches as demotivating for athletes.
Right.
This is Fairfax County, Virginia, and I'll read you a little bit. I'll start with the headline of this column. It says, disadvantaged kids hurt by keeping pandemic's relaxed teaching style. And I think you had spoken plenty about this
right.
with Puget Sound area schools, moving away from letter grades and just doing pass-fail during the online learning. Well, this columnist points to an educator in Fairfax County, Virginia, and the educator writes, quote, "The education system is now considering these policies that have provided struggling students an alternative pathway to graduation be used with all students. Instead of being the exception," he writes, "it is becoming the rule. This is dangerous." So there's an educator, you know, who thinks that this is a problem.
We have been here before. We have been here before. I remember when I was a kid, and I went to a private school, Holy Rosary Elementary in West Seattle. I remember there was like a four-year period where the school abandoned traditional grades, just abandoned report cards, and instead would have the teacher simply write in how you were progressing and marking a box, you know, does well, could use improvement, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And for several years, they abandoned report cards. And then, of course, they went back to them because almost all reforms in the 60s were terrible ideas. When we come back, we'll tell you what happened yesterday throughout the country with the elections. A lot of important takeaways.
You hold me, I'm still not certain that you care. No, you keep on saying you really, really, really love me.
Irreverent, entertaining, and unafraid. Dana Lash, The Dana Show, weekdays 6 to 9 p.m. KVI, KVI.com.
So there was a Republican primary election yesterday in Nextdoor, Oregon, and in Nextdoor, Idaho, and across the country in Kentucky, on the southeast in North Carolina, and in Pennsylvania. And there are some very interesting takeaways. And when I want to survey the landscape of the political map, the guy I talk to, if we can get him, and we're lucky enough that we can for a segment, John Fund from NationalReview.com. John Fund, thank you for making the time this morning.
Pleasure. Thanks, John.
Okay. Let's start in Idaho, where you had a populist right-winger running against what many people would consider a very successful and productive conservative Republican governor. Not even close there.
No, and of course the same thing happened I think the race is down the ballot. With the exception of Attorney General, Raul Labrador, who was a former congressman, was very active in trying to curb illegal immigration. He won the primary for Attorney General. He'll be a fighting activist conservative in that spot.
But, I mean, we were talking, you know, would Governor Little, you know, win by 5 points, 10 points? My goodness, I think he won by 25, if I'm not mistaken, John.
Incumbent governors do that.
Yes. Let's go to the state everybody's talking about this morning. That is Pennsylvania. What is your take on what happened there? Let's start with the U.S. Senate primary and then go to the governor's race.
There's some absentee ballots still to be counted, but I think the odds are that Mehmet Oz, Dr. Oz, is going to be the Republican candidate in the fall. And the Trump vote was split between Kathy Barnett, who was an African-American conservative activist, and Oz. Dave McCormick, who was more of the establishment choice, made it very close. He got about a third of the vote. Ultimately, I think it's going to be Oz.
Is he going to win in November?
Yes. Pennsylvania is trending Republican. The governor's race may be somewhat different. The Republicans have nominated someone. The state senator was a participant in the January 6th demonstration, is sort of like a MAGA Trump candidate.
Mastriano.
But he has no money, and it'll be hard for him to get the party back together. It might be possible, but I wouldn't count on it.
Why did he win by such a large margin, Senator Mastriano?
He obviously touched a chord with primary voters, and the rest of the field was fragmented and squabbling, and you know, Trump's did not endorse him until 3 days before the election. So he did most of that on his own.
Yes. Yeah, no, and he was well ahead for most of this race. Let's turn to the Democrats now, because a lot of people are starting to talk up the name of John Fetterman. He is the current lieutenant governor. Big guy, bald-headed, has chin whiskers with no mustache.
Campaigns in gym shorts.
Campaigns in gym shorts. And he won by like 25 percentage points. Rolling Stone magazine says this is our answer to Trump, John Fetterman.
Well, John Fetterman was a Bernie Sanders guy in 2016 and 2020. We'll see. We'll see if Pennsylvania is ready for a full-throated left-wing populist. I think, in general, the progressives did well last night in the Democratic primaries. They apparently have won in Pittsburgh. And the big news in Oregon is that Kurt Schrader, a moderate Democrat in the Clackamas area, has lost in a landslide to a progressive from Bend, Oregon.
That is true. And
that seat, though, will be very contested in the fall because the Republicans have a strong woman, former mayor, running there.
I want to move to North Carolina real quickly. A politician who is getting all sorts of attention for all the wrong reasons much of the time, 25-year-old Madison Cawthorn, the youngest member of Congress, just 25 years of age, wheelchair-bound from a tragic automobile accident, but very outspoken and very reckless at times. And, you know, he had a guy, the table was set for this guy to grow his career, and instead he gets taken out in the Republican primary, John.
Well, you know, it's kind of sad. At 26, he'll be a former congressman, and with the rest of his life ahead of him, I hope he can piece his life back together. I suspect that this will be a wake-up call for him. And the Republicans, though, were simply tired of scandal and controversy following him like a dark cloud everywhere.
So I want to run a couple of numbers by you, because I think that the most important overlooked parts of the primary were voter turnout, overall voter turnout. For instance, in North Carolina, in the Republican senatorial primary, 701,000 people voted in the Republican primary. 540 turned out in the Democratic primary. In Oregon, on the other hand, the Republicans had 157,000 people turn out to vote in the Republican primary. The Democrats had 306,000, John. How important are these numbers?
I don't know the significance, because remember, some of those primaries were very competitive, some were not. Oregon's primaries were not that competitive, but they had several vacant congressional seats that might have boosted Democratic turnout. I don't think you can draw a lot of lessons from that. It's very state by state. The big news in Kentucky is the leading opponent of school choice in the Republican Party in Kentucky was defeated in a landslide. It looks like Kentucky is probably on its way to getting more charter schools and more school choice.
Oh, that is wonderful. That is great. And in Kentucky, it's long, long overdue. Here's something interesting. In Pennsylvania, the Republican turnout in the Senate primaries was 1.28 million, but the Democrats were very close. It was 1.12 million. So the earlier indications were that Republicans were far, far showing up in far greater numbers than the Democrats. But that doesn't seem to be the case.
On the other hand, it was a very ugly race. I mean, Oz and McCormick spent several tens of millions of dollars trashing each other. Sometimes that reduces turnout. Pennsylvania is a competitive state. Democrats have a registration edge, but that's been shrinking. Again, I think that it's probably too much to read a lot into primary turnout. We're going to have six more months of election campaigning, and that's going to be decisive.
Overall, if you had to pick the three top takeaways from yesterday's primaries all over the country, what would they be? One, two, three.
Republicans look as if they're going to do very well in North Carolina. Pennsylvania is going to be very competitive. It'll be interesting to see if the Trump candidate for governor in Pennsylvania can raise the money to be competitive. And I think that in general, the progressives are riding high in the Democratic primaries. And, you know, if you're a moderate Democrat, like Henry Cuellar, who's up in a week in Texas, you should probably be nervous.
Right. By the way, let me take you back in the time machine. Do you remember a very outspoken freshman Republican member of Congress got elected in 1980 named John Leboutier?
Harvard Hates America, yes.
Yes. That was the book he wrote, Harvard Hates America, right. And used that to make it to Congress. Very outspoken, very unvarnished, and one term later, he was gone. So
it can happen. Redistricting, that was a redistricting move. New York redistricted. And by the way, the Democratic gerrymander in New York is gone. The courts found it so outrageous that they threw it out. I'm opposed to gerrymandering by either party. In this case, the Democrats are the ones screaming. They've been hoisted by their own gerrymandering petard.
Yes. No, exact. Great point. Great point, John Fund. Thank you very much. I know it's a very busy morning for you, so I appreciate you squeezing us in here on the John Carlson Show.
Rest your eyes. Engage your ears. Talk Radio 570 KVI. When you're with
the sun ain't gonna shine anymore. That song could have been written this spring. Oh. Welcome back, everybody, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI with my good buddy Lars Larson. It is 8 minutes to 7 o'clock. Okay. This is very important. Oregon had a Democratic and Republican primary election yesterday as well. And there were some big things that happened. John Fund mentioned a couple of them. What's interesting is that the Democrats nominated an ardently liberal Portland politician named Tina Kotek, the former House Speaker. And that has left open the possibility of a third party candidate. Anyway, let's get the details here from Lars Larson, who does our Northwest show from noon to three. Lars?
There's a very big chance of that. And I know there are three women who are now running for Oregon governor. There is Tina Kotek, who is so far off to the left, you need a telescope to see her. Right. She is a far lefty, and they're all heralding she may become the nation's first lesbian governor. Well, Kate Brown was bisexual, so I don't know. I guess we got to count all these little, notable items based on people's sexuality, even though I would hope that people's sexuality doesn't affect the kind of decision making they make as a CEO or as a governor. Then you've got Christine Drazen, who's not the most conservative Republican in the world, but she won the primary, or appears to have won the primary, because there are problems with the vote count, because one of the major counties had problems with its barcodes and didn't notice them until all the ballots were out already. And then you've got the third person is Betsy Johnson. Now, I've known Betsy Johnson for decades. She is a former Democrat, now an independent, running an independent candidacy for governor, which has worked about 100 years, not quite 100 years ago in Oregon. We had an independent candidate run and won the governor. Governorship. Betsy Johnson is very popular. She is a conservative Democrat. And when I say that, I'm not just saying, some nice things about her. She votes for gun rights. She votes against tax increases. She manages to make her own party angry a lot of the time. And she was a very powerful figure within the legislature, but she left, unregistered as a Democrat, runs an independent campaign, has attracted the support of Phil Knight, the biggest stockholder in Nike and the creator of Nike, who's given her $1 million, which he's allowed to do in the state of Oregon. And she might just go through and win this one. And
okay,
Tina Kotek is so far to the left, it's hard to imagine.
Okay. I'm going to put Lars Larson on the spot, ladies and gentlemen. If the election was held tomorrow, you had a choice between the Republican, Drayson, the Democrat, Kotek, or the independent third-party candidate, Betsy Johnson, who would earn your vote?
It'd have to be Betsy Johnson. And here's why. Not because I want to vote for a former Democrat, but because I think her positions on the issues are solid. Christine Drazen was the House Minority Leader, could have taken actions to block some really execrable legislation that got passed, chose not to. She kind of went along to go along and get along. And I hate that in Republicans. I just couldn't see myself voting for her.
I admire Betsy Johnson for pushing back and defying her own party, doing the principled thing of getting out of the party and then re-registering as an independent to run. I would vote for Betsy Johnson as well.
You found it, the best place for live, local, conservative talk in the morning. The Commute with Carlson, stimulating, entertaining, and making a difference. Here's John Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
To the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Thank you ever so much for being with me here this morning. Go ahead, give me a shout on the Genuine Auto Glass Studio lines at 206-421-5757. Outside King County, got 888-312-5757. If you want to hear somebody who is so completely unhinged from reality, Donnie Deutsch was a successful advertising agency director back in New York, and then he got a gig as one of the people sitting around talking on the Joe Scarborough show, Morning Joe show on MSNBC. And of all the inane things that are said on that program from time to time, Donnie Deutsch probably says about 90% of them. Here is what he had to say, giving advice to the Democrats. Here's where you go from here if you want to defeat the Republicans in November. Have a listen.
Brand every Republican. This is the party of the replacement theory. Take what is a sliver, or I'm a real minority, but a minority, and make it the entire raison d'etre of the Republican Party. Do the same thing with violence. It's the RV party. It's the Republican Violence Party. Brand them. This is judo. The very, very heinous things that they stand for and are hiding behind, brand them on it. Take a branding iron, put it on them so that any mainstream Republican has to wear that badge and go, are you voting Republican? Do you understand you're voting for the replacement theory? Do you believe in that? Is that what you stand for? Do you believe that immigrants are coming over to replace white people and it's part of a Jewish cabal planning this whole thing and through interracial marriage? Do you believe, because that's the Republican platform. So make the Republicans own it.
It is? There's a Jewish cabal at work trying to change the demographic characteristics of America? That's the Republican platform? Okay. One of the things I take a little bit of pride in is that a number of folks who are not conservatively inclined, in other words, people who don't share my political views, they still like the show. They like the show because they know they get really good information, really good insight, really good analysis, even if they don't agree where I may land. They appreciate having that perspective. So to all you Democrats out there, please take Donnie Deutsch's advice. I hope every Democrat in the country runs on that meme. I hope they run with that approach. The Republicans are the Republican Violence Party. The Republicans are all about replacement theory. To which I'm guessing the average voter would probably say, replacement theory? Theory. If you've ever needed a clearer, sharper snapshot of how an inside the DC Beltway guy could be so completely oblivious to everyday reality, this is your example right there. I mean, this is, again, but this is pretty much MSNBC. This is where they are these days. When you start falling behind on so many different fronts that you begin panicking, this is the kind of nonsense that results from panicking.
This is judo.
No, this is panicking. And why are they panicking? Well, they're going to be running for re-election, and they're going to be saying our policies work best for you. So the average voter is saying, really? Because inflation's really bothering me right now. I mean, it's 8.5% nationally, but when it comes to food, you know, eggs are up almost by 25%. Gasoline is up by more than a third. And don't be blaming Putin for all that, because gasoline was going up long before he invaded Ukraine. I don't see anything getting better on your watch. The border is wide open. Criminality and trafficking is literally being encouraged by an open, porous border. The evacuation from Afghanistan was an utter fiasco that Biden's administration reacted to by saying, oh, no, it was actually really good. You talk about people who don't want to look at reality and take stock about what they need to do different. So my point here is, what are they going to run on? And you just heard Donnie Deutsch. Here's what you do. Just say the Republicans are the Republican Violence Party, and they're the party of replacement theory.
Brand them on. Take a branding iron, Put it on them.
See how that works. Go ahead. Campaign on that. I love it. Tell you, this is like an in-kind donation to Republican candidates everywhere. And by the way, Joe Biden's solution to inflation is to raise taxes among wealthy people. Now, Pete Ducey asked a very common sense question of the new press spokesperson. Jen Psaki has fled, predictably, for MSNBC, where she had really been the last couple of years, but instead of being on the news set, now White House podium, now she's on the news set. And her place is being taken by Karine Jean-Pierre, who got her start with the radical organization MoveOn.org, and who made a name for herself by denying that Donald Trump was the rightful winner of the 2016 election. That was back when questioning the results of a national election was not tantamount to treachery, but just telling some hard truths. And for good measure, 2 years later, she denied that Stacey Abrams really lost the Georgia governor's race, which she really did lose by 50,000 votes. Anyway, have a listen to Pete Ducey questioning Karine Jean-Pierre and watch her dance, frantically looking for a way to plausibly explain Joe Biden's position.
The president's Twitter account posted the other day, you want to bring down inflation, let's make sure the wealthiest corporations pay their fair share. Mm-hmm. How does raising taxes on corporations reduce inflation?
Are you talking about a specific tweet?
He tweeted, you want to bring down inflation, let's make sure the wealthiest corporations pay their fair share.
Look, you know, we have talked about this past year about making sure that the wealthiest among us are paying their fair share, and that is important to do, and that is something that you know, the president has been, you know, working on every day when we talk about inflation.
Okay, stop the tape. He didn't ask if it's something that Joe Biden was pushing for. Everybody knows he's been pushing for that. He didn't ask whether the Biden administration has been talking about it. Everybody knows they've been talking about it. What he said was, The president said if you want to bring down inflation, you should raise taxes on the wealthy. What is the connection between raising taxes on wealthy people and lowering inflation? What's the connection there? And she has no idea, and she's looking now at the briefing book, and you can tell she's trying to find a paragraph somewhere, you know, a lily pad she could jump on, and it ain't happening. Let's continue.
Every day when we talk about inflation and lowering costs. And so it's very important that, you know, as we're seeing costs rise, as we're talking about how to, build an America that's safe, that's equal for everyone and doesn't leave anyone behind, that is an important part of that as well.
But how does raising taxes on corporations lower the cost of gas, the cost of a used car, the cost of food for everyday Americans?
So, look, I think we encourage those who have done very well, right? Especially those who care about climate change to
Stop
support.
The tape. What? What does climate change have to do with any of this? Again, she is grasping for catchphrases and cliches and sentence fragments that will somehow, in this word salad, come together. I mean, this is worse than Kamala Harris. Let's continue.
Fair tax code that doesn't change, that doesn't charge manufacturers, workers, cops, builders a higher percentage of their earnings, that the most fortunate people in our nation, and not let that stand in the way of reducing energy costs and fighting this existential problem, if you think about that as an example, and to support basic collective bargaining rights as well, right? That's also important. But look, it is, you know, by not, if, without having a fair tax code, which is what I'm talking about, then all like manufacturing workers, cops, you know, it's not fair for them to have to pay higher taxes than the folks that who are not paying taxes at all.
Well, stop the tape. Weren't we supposed to be talking about inflation here?
Yeah, the higher taxes of inflation, but she's not talking about that, is she?
Weren't we supposed to be talking about how to combat inflation?
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get the summary here.
Yeah,
from
just the last few seconds here.
It has to do with inflation. The president said, you want to bring down inflation, let's make sure the wealthiest corporations pay their fair share.
Right.
She was almost like that Miss Teen South Carolina contestant back like almost 15, 20 years ago.
Oh, my Lord.
Trying to answer
yes.
about Iran and the Iraq. And she just had
no answer yes.
and stammered and got more confused and got more
opposition
exposed.
To apartheid and... a clean air and a better society for everyone. Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. I remember.
Yeah. And that's how it comes off with Karine Jean-Pierre in that moment.
But Karine Jean-Pierre does want you to know, as did her predecessor, want you to know that Karine is the first woman of color member of the LGBTQ community to be a White House press spokesman. Okay. That somehow isn't making her sound any more persuasive or any more compelling or any less preposterous than what you just heard over the last couple of minutes.
For the stories and opinion to start your day, it's the Social Media Sweep on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
Friday night and the lights are low. Next to Volvo, the best import from Sweden in the 1970s. ABBA.
Did you ever hear that there was a fish company in Sweden with the same name ABBA, and they said that you can't spell it the same? That's why the logo was A, backward B, normal B, A. And you can pronounce it the same.
That's how you spell ABBA in the Seattle Public Schools.
Right.
Oh, okay.
With the backward. And anyway, that's an issue.
Swedes don't have their B's backwards all the time? Is that the answer?
Lots of things.
Like the O with the line through it?
Oh, the stories. Oh, boy.
All right, Philip J. Vandenbort III, go ahead and tell us what is trending in the social media world here at 725.
I've spoken about this particular social media person before. Her name's Olivia Rondo. She ends up on Fox Business News from time to time as a commentator. She's a libertarian. She's an African-American woman. And she posted about the Buffalo, New York shooting the following. This is the mass murder at the Buffalo, New York grocery store.
Right, right.
18-year-old white suspect now going to be charged likely with hate crime, killing at least 10, shooting and a couple of others. And she writes, I don't know about y'all, but a crazy white supremacist with a 180-page manifesto talking about kill as many blacks as possible makes me want more gun rights, not less. And she adds, he literally took advantage of the fact that no civilians would be open carrying. Wake up, she writes. And she links a Newsweek.com story that's headlined, Buffalo Shooter Saw New York's Gun Laws as His Advantage. And that idea that, according to the Buffalo News, Newsweek writes, law enforcement officials say they believe that the 18-year-old shooter did this as a soft target. Would not get resistance.
You know, it's interesting you say that because I was thinking Monday, you know, after, you know, this news had been percolating, the, you know, dust was still not settled. What if he had gone into a grocery store in Abilene, Texas, or, you know, in some other Texas locale? My guess is a couple of the people in that store probably would have returned fire. Might have been in a position to defend themselves. That I think a lot of people, we'll talk about that coming up after the 7:30 headlines.
Leaving the progressive agenda in itty bitty pieces. Ari Hoffman, weekdays 3 to 6. KVI, KVI.com.
Minutes now after 7 o'clock in the morning, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Just a few minutes ago, we were playing just the epic Q&A back and forth at the White House between Fox News White House correspondent Pete Ducey and the brand new, newly minted White House press spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre. And the issue that Ducey was asking is that Joe Biden had tweeted out that one way to battle inflation is to get wealthy people, corporations, to pay more in taxes. And so he asked, well, what's the connection there? How does raising taxes bring down inflation? And then Jean-Pierre was just dancing all over the place. She had no idea. She doesn't understand economics in the first place. All she understands is political activism. While we were playing that, Philip J. Vandenbort III said, you know, this reminds me of that Q&A they held with Miss Teen. Was it Miss Teen South Carolina?
Yeah, back in 2007.
Back in 2007, you know, when they asked the contestants a question for Miss Teen USA, and Miss Teen South Carolina was asked a question, and here's how she responded.
The president's Twitter account posted the other day, you want to bring down inflation, let's make sure the wealthiest corporations pay their fair share. Mm-hmm. How does raising taxes on corporations reduce inflation?
I personally believe that U.S. Americans are unable to do so because some people out there in our nation don't have that.
But how does raising taxes on corporations lower the cost of gas, the cost of a used car, the cost of food for everyday Americans?
And I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and I believe that they should, our education over here in the U.S. should help the U.S. Or should help South Africa and should help the Iraq and the Asian countries. So we will be able to build up our future for our children.
Thank you very much.
Okay, now let's juxtapose that with Karine Jean-Pierre. And okay. You tell me who sounds more senseless, who sounds more moronic, Miss Teen South Carolina in 2007 or Karine Jean-Pierre? Have a listen.
You want to bring down inflation, let's make sure the wealthiest corporations pay their fair share.
Look, you know, we have talked about this past year, about making sure that the wealthiest among us are paying their fair share. And that is important to do. And that is something that, the president has been, working on every day when we talk about inflation and lowering costs. And so it's very important that as we're seeing costs rise, as we're talking about how to, build America. America that's safe, that's equal for everyone, and doesn't leave anyone behind. That is an important part of that as well.
But I can't tell the difference. I can't tell the difference, which means I don't know where she is today. But if Karine Jean-Pierre does leave her post, Miss Teen South Carolina from 2007 is ready to step in and continue that tradition.
South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and
you're listening to the radio program of record, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Just before the break, Phil, during the social media moment, was talking about a tweet where somebody said, hey, has anyone, stopped to think that instead of this awful mass murder in Buffalo leading to calls for more gun control, maybe it's a clarion call for more law-abiding people to be armed?
Yeah, the Newsweek.com piece says the Giffords Law Center states that the New York State residents are prohibited from openly carrying a loaded handgun outside of their homes without a carry license. And so according to the Giffords Law Center, the state prohibits any person from possessing a loaded short-barreled shotgun or rifle or an assault weapon outside of his or her home or place of business. New York does not issue licenses to carry handguns openly.
And I think this shows kind of a disconnect between elites and regular, ordinary folks. When you have an example of an awful shooting, an awful crime, an awful attack that involves firearms, that always, cue the gun control cliches, and you begin to hear, we need to stop gun violence, we need to remove guns from society, there are too many guns in America, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But most normal, everyday, average folks, when they hear about something awful involving gunfire in their community or their neighborhood, what they're thinking is, I need to protect myself. I need to protect my family. I need to protect my home. And they're more likely to think about, hey, I need a gun. If crazy people are going to have guns, if criminals are going to have guns, and who knows when they could be pulled and shot at any moment when I'm at work, when I'm out shopping, when I'm in the backyard and someone's cruising by our home. I need to know that my family and I are safe. I don't think that the elite have figured this one out yet. I don't think they get it. And it shows that most people within the elite, the liberal elite, they keep focusing on the means of violence, the gun, while most regular folks are focused on the people responsible for the violence. And say, you know, if you can't protect me, if you can't protect our community, I'm going to protect myself. That's just what you would expect. And, you know, Philip Jay had mentioned that the gun control laws, well, actually he was quoting, I think, Buffalo law enforcement officials, who said that New York's very stringent gun control laws may have had a role in the shooter's decision to carry out the attack in New York, in Buffalo. You know, he had to drive 200 miles to get there. And you'll notice, being the coward that he is, that, you know, instead of going to a high crime area, he goes to a grocery store where, you know, 86-year-old women who had just visited their husband in the nursing home, and, you know, most of the people he shot were over 50. Again, they're just going grocery shopping on the weekend. So just something to think about. You know, if he had tried to pull that in Abilene, Texas, I'm guessing that at least one or two people probably would have fired back. And I know what you're thinking. Well, he had body armor because a security guard did engage him and did shoot him. But it didn't work because the body armor protected the bullet from penetrating. But if you have several people shooting, might be a little different. Can't cover everything. And this much I'm absolutely adamant about. I hope he is facing federal charges, because under federal law, the Buffalo shooter can be tried for a death penalty offense. The state of New York does not have a death penalty. But if you're under federal jurisdiction, if you're hit with federal charges, you can be executed. This is why we have a death penalty law, to get the worst of the worst who do the worst out of society for good. You're actually making a statement about the sanctity of innocent life when you hand out, mete out the most severe punishment that you can think of for someone who would do something like that. I feel the same way for the guy down in Orange County, California, at the Presbyterian Church that was used by a Taiwanese Presbyterian congregation. This guy, again, with all sorts of malice aforethought, shows up for a luncheon, is there socializing with people for an hour, and then walks to the back of the room, closes the doors, super glues the keyholes, wraps a chain around the door, pulls out not only two handguns, but has a bag with four explosive devices. Again, this was a premeditated assault on these Taiwanese people who were targeted by this shooter, who himself is Chinese from Taiwan, because he's now anti-Taiwan and pro-Red China. And so he now hates these people. And he was subdued, but the man who played the lead role in subduing him, a doctor, Dr. John Chung, was shot and killed. So he kept who knows how many people from being killed, but paid for that heroism with his life. The guy who did that, killed him and wounded five other people, he should be up on federal charges, so he can be executed as well. That's not vengeance. Okay, that's not some emotional reaction. That is what justice requires for that kind of cruel premeditation.
My senses like night in a forest.
More than 30 years of conservative talk, still the original, the only KVI.
Walk in the rain, like a storm in the desert.
6 minutes to 8 o'clock.
Like a sleepy blue ocean.
I don't know, Mark Christopher, why did John Denver want his girlfriend to fill out his census form?
I thought it was a promo for your show. You fill up my senses like a walk in the forest.
Anyway.
Great lyric of life.
You are listening to the radio program of record. Get this. The Edmonds City Council has decided to follow through and pass that tough love anti-homeless camping ordinance. Here's Northwest Radio's Corwin Hake.
The ordinance the Edmonds City Council passed Tuesday following a public hearing creates a new misdemeanor, unlawful occupation. Under this law, police may arrest and charge those camping on park space or on sidewalks if they refuse an offer of shelter. This resident spoke emphatically in favor.
Giving our police department the tools they need to protect the public and also help individuals in need is a compassionate thing to do.
But many who addressed the council complained about the creation of a new criminal ordinance.
It's absolutely does criminalize homelessness. It criminalizes poverty.
It took Edmonds several meetings like this one to come up with an acceptable plan. This plan defines available shelter as anything within 35 miles of Edmonds. Declining a shelter bed within that range could lead to arrest. Corwin Hake, Northwest News Radio.
How can such a charming community have so many dumb people living there? And they all show up for the city council meeting. Well, I'm glad they defied them and passed this common sense measure. More of the same, please. More of the same. Let's get to your 8 o'clock headlines.
Be careful of the neighborhood strays.
You found it. The best place for live, local, conservative talk in the morning. The Commute with Carlson. Stimulating, entertaining, and making a difference. Here's John Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
Supersonic, metatonic, stereophonic, labatonic, the boom is bionic, Sony shutdown, Megabox meltdown, bonus to breakdown, high five, heat wave, lo-fi.
All right. That's a local band. In fact, the band is Presidents of the United States of America. And since it mentioned St. Helens, we went ahead and played that. It was almost exactly 42 years ago to the moment when Mount St. Helens blew on what was then, I believe, Sunday morning.
Yeah.
May 18th. I was hiking up Mount Si at the time and did not notice anything out of the ordinary. Other than it just seemed very dark and cloudy, you know, looking in that direction. And we didn't know the mountain had blown because, you know, back then, no social media, you know, no reports.
No cell phone.
We didn't have radio with us. So not until we came down did we hear that the mountain had blown. I have been, and I want to suggest you do this as well. I have been to the Mount St. Helens Visitors Center. There's two visitors centers. And try and get to them both. The thing about Mount St. Helens is that it's unlike virtually any other place in the United States. You're just not going to see a massive volcano with, again, the top still blown off the mountain, and it looks like it happened last week. Okay. It hasn't filled in. And the scenery is spectacular. You can see much of it by car. Yes, you can get out and hike. In fact, you can even climb the mountain. I've climbed it twice, though I should say in the summer, Mount St. Helens is more of a hiking mountain and a rock scramble than it is a technical mountain. In winter and late spring, it's a little to late spring, it's a little different. But the bottom line here is, it really is one of the most wondrous scenes to take in this country. You know, one of the things I love about Yellowstone is that you see things at Yellowstone you just don't see anywhere else in America. Just geologically speaking, it is such a unique area. Well, there's plenty of mountains in the United States, but you're not going to see one quite like Mount St. Helens. And by the way, if you do climb Mount St. Helens, it's a lot quicker than it was 40 years ago. There's 1,300 fewer vertical feet. That's two space needles to climb than it was back in the 70s. Anyway, yeah, if you want to call with your own unique story about Mount St. Helens, it's the third hour of the show that we have extra leeway latitude for your phone calls. So go ahead, give us a shout here. 206-421-5757. Outside King County, got 888-312-5757. And by the way, there is an organization, and we've had them on the show in the past when I was raising money from KVI listeners for the climb to fight breast cancer, and the mountain I had chosen to climb was Mount St. Helens. There is an organization called the Mount St. Helens Institute. In fact, that's where you get your climbing permits. If you have a chance, go online. You can just Google Mount St. Helens Institute and see all the great things. They have so many family-friendly activities, and there are so many things to do. It is worth a long day trip, or make it an overnighter, because there's a second really great attraction to the Mount St. Helens area, and that is at the base of Mount St. Helens, there are these underground caves, and they're called ape caves. But you know what they really are? They're lava tubes from previous eruptions of Mount St. Helens going back many thousands of years. And you can find these what are called ape caves because a group of guys calling themselves, they had a club, they called themselves the Apes, found by accident the lava tubes back in, I'm guessing, what, the 40s or 50s, Mark Christopher?
Yeah, that's about right, the 40s.
And it turns out that there's an entire underground network of these caves. So that's another reason to head out to Mount St. Helens.
Yeah, and John, I've done those before, too. And I remember one of the guides that we had, he said, "Now be careful. Make sure everybody has a lantern because yeah. They're so pitch dark. And some of these go on for miles. Real spooky." And my dad used to take us all camping there at Mount St. Helens for years, long before the eruption. The forest lands were so thick. You could see a deer blink your eye. It's gone. You couldn't tell if it went left, right, or ran beside you. Yeah. And I got to say, too, it's been interesting, especially on the media side, all these years that have gone by with so many people involved with recovery and the Mount St. Helens, you know, watch here as it's evolved here since that eruption here 42 years ago. I remember one pilot from JBLM, and he was doing some of the scouting there as they were, you know, doing some of the recovery for humans. And then they went for carcasses of animals. But he said, "Mark, I remember one time we went over a hillside and found this huge pond-like lake that was formed from the eruption. There was a bunch of these like that." And he said it was weird because we looked down, and he said, "I didn't have a camera, but we had elk, deer, bear, cougar, bobcat, and other species all along the shoreline not even paying attention to each other, but they were so thirsty, they were just all drinking the water in respect of each other in survival. He said it was the most bizarre thing he had ever seen. The effect on the mountain and the animals there, but still
after
all this day.
Eruption.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, if you ever go to eastern Washington or near Moses Lake, a popular area south of Moses Lake is called the Potholes Reservoir. A lot of people do boating trips over there, and there's just hundreds of little islands in this huge reservoir. If you go and look at some of those little islands, you'll see where some of them, the little hillsides are busted loose, and you have a little cliff. And if you look at the dirt, you'll see the different levels of dirt through the years, and suddenly you'll see about a foot of some real gray-looking matter, and then back to the dirt. That's ash from Mount St. Helens 42 years ago.
Yeah. No, it is interesting. And if, you know, there are you can drive up and go on a series of hikes, and you might be able to see this on one of your hikes, or you definitely will if you climb St. Helens and it's a clear day, you can see what's left of Spirit Lake, which was once a favorite recreational lake.
Yeah.
And if you look very carefully and, you know, maybe having a telescope or, you know, a miniature telescope, binoculars, whatever would help, you will see what looks like sand. Coming off from the shore. But it's not sand. Those are logs that had been stripped bare as trees and then tumbled into the water, which are still there bobbing up and down in Spirit Lake 42 years later. It's fascinating.
It's amazing, too. And I had to look. On eBay, you won't believe how many people are still selling vintage Mount St. Helens ash taken from Yakima. $65 a jar for a jar full. You can get one here. It says a half ounce of Mount St. Helens ash. I don't know how they prove authenticity, but $15.50 up to $65. They're all over eBay this morning.
I was going to say, back then, you literally couldn't give the stuff away, and you wanted to because it was such a nuisance. Anyways, coming up here on 17 minutes after 8 o'clock, the police chief of Spokane is furious with all the growing crime that is tied to drug trafficking, and he knows precisely who is to blame for creating the conditions for all of this mayhem and crime and drug trafficking. I'll tell you who he's blaming coming up at 8:35 on the John Carlson Show. Philip J. Vandenberg III right around the corner with his favorite segment of the day, social media from socialists.
Let me say it now. I don't know where I'm going to go when the volcano blows.
KVI.
Upside down, you're turning me. You're giving love instinctively. Round and round, you're turning me.
Checking the pulse of politics every hour on The Commute with Carlson. It's the Social Media Sweep on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
Upside down, boy, you turn me.
23 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning on The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Philip J's favorite segment of the day, social media from socialists. What's going on? You have a lot to choose from.
Yeah, I've come across a social media account, Twitter, Starbucks worker solidarity. And of course, you know, the stories we've talked about them on this segment on the show and your show in general here of trying to unionize at Starbucks shops. So here's some sounds of union supporters in Seattle chanting, "Get up, get down. Seattle is a union town." Banging on drums. Got a lot of rhythm.
Yeah, I've heard better.
And so they posted this video. I wanted to play you their chant there, their cute little chant, "Get up, get down, Seattle is a union town." But in the video that they posted on their social media handle, they're walking around with signs that say, "One job should be enough," at a Starbucks. And I'm trying to decipher what exactly do they mean when they say one job should be enough.
Well, look, the obvious question is enough for what?
Yeah, yeah. Another great question.
Because when I was in my 20s, I had a roommate. Instead of getting a cramped little studio, I get a nice, spacious two-bedroom apartment, but I made sure I had a roommate. Secondly, I had a job, a full-time job, and then I had a part-time job as well. That was just, if I want to live a kind of lifestyle and set aside money for buying a home, I need to get busy right now. Mm-hmm. So I didn't, you know, the idea of saying one job should be enough didn't occur to me.
Yeah,
it's you earn what you need by working as much as is required to get what you want.
Yeah. I was wondering, do they think they should only have to work one job of their choosing that rewards them with a home or an apartment, food, clothing, their vices, their leisure, their travel, and whatever other material desires they have, that they should get all of that from working one job of their choosing? And this is the mentality of people that are in the labor union movement, that I shouldn't have to do more, but you should give me everything that I'm asking for.
Well, especially if you're talking about a job at Starbucks.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if you want to have a job at Starbucks that will pay a good career-type wage, then you need to get on a career ladder.
Yeah, there, rather than an entry-level type position at the store, correct?
And just expect that all your needs will be taken care of. Yeah. And the world is a little more complex than that. And you might have to actually work more than 30 hours a week.
Yeah. Let's move along to all of the condemnation of Fox News and Tucker Carlson as it relates to the Buffalo, New York mass murder shooting. I'm looking at a post from someone who says that they are a Democratic digital strategist, a Gen Z activist, and set to graduate from Dartmouth University in 3 more years. So possibly a freshman or a sophomore at Dartmouth, Jack Cocciarella. And he posts, who else thinks Tucker Carlson is too dangerous to be on TV? And this individual has
every member of the Democratic Party. Yeah. He's ruining their parade.
Yeah,
but go ahead.
This individual has 184,000 followers. But we'll have to see how many of those are bots after Elon Musk gets a chance to have the audit done of Twitter accounts. But this is, you know, a Democratic digital strategist
Dartmouth. I just love the assumption, I don't like him, therefore, no one should be allowed to listen to him. You know, how about if you don't like him, turn the channel? Your freedom of choice, free expression still has its place. Again, but not on the political left. They never have believed him.
You got so much love.
Turning up the overnight heat from the right side of the aisle. Red Eye Radio. Weeknights, 11 p.m. to 5 a.m. KVI. KVI.com.
Oh, this news just out minutes ago. The Joe Biden administration is considering shuttering, closing down, walking away from the so-called Disinformation Governance Board. So much criticism that they're questioning whether it's worth it.
Did that Jeff Bezos tweet last Friday push him over the edge?
Probably didn't. Yeah, when they say, hey, wait, this could be used against us? The Department of Homeland Security is considering shutting down its just created, as of 3 weeks ago, Disinformation Governance Board, which was officially tasked with allegedly combating false narratives around domestic terrorism and human trafficking around the border, but what was much more widely interpreted as having a broader authority to monitor and maybe curtail political speech they didn't like. Again, less than a month after its creation, the Disinformation Board's operations have been, quote, paused, close quote, multiple anonymous Department of Homeland Security officials told the Washington Post. Keep in mind, this government disinformation board would have been under the auspices, under the authority of the Department of Homeland Security. The department has reportedly decided to just shut down the board entirely as of yesterday. Its director, controversial director Nina Jankowicz, has tendered a voluntary resignation letter. But DHS officials called her to give her the option to stay on while the Homeland Security Advisory Committee determines whether to shut down the board entirely.
Rudy Giuliani shared that intel from Ukraine. Oh, when TikTok influencers say COVID can cause pain, they're laundering disinfo and we really should take note.
How will the federal government ever get along without that kind of trenchant social commentary from Nina Jankowicz? Anyway, she has been harshly criticized for both her political partisanship and her record and her, quote, online behavior, which included her vocal discrediting of the Hunter Biden laptop story, which, of course, has now been verified.
We choose truth over facts.
And also her support for Christopher Steele, who authored the now discredited so-called dossier on former President Donald Trump. So it looks like that whole thing is about to crash and burn. Anyway, again, if you're just joining me, it looks like the Biden administration is shutting down the Disinformation Governance Board barely 3 weeks after announcing its creation.
Oh, information laundering is really quite ferocious. It's when a huckster takes some lies and makes them sound precocious by saying them in Congress or a mainstream outlet show. Disinformation's origin seems slightly less atrocious.
She went to Princeton. Let's not forget that.
Is she one of the ones that's asking for her student debt to be forgiven?
She, you know what she should be asking for? A refund. Anyway.
I'm sure she'll make it into the Princeton Alumni Magazine Quarterly that they do.
Oh, yeah. You know, something like that. They're just going to have to hastily change her profile. Hastily change her biographical sketch.
She can add that to her LinkedIn dossier profile.
So let us turn to the big political news yesterday, which is that there were primary elections in five states: Oregon, Idaho, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Kentucky. And there were a few takeaways that were very interesting. One of them is that in North Carolina, the controversial and very young Congressman Madison Cawthorn, 25 years of age, he's the youngest member of Congress, and he's out on his ear after one term. Too loud, too obnoxious, too wrong on so many issues, too untrustworthy. And a lot of people who pulled for him and helped him 2 years ago actively opposed his reelection. He lost his primary to a, if you will, kind of a standard issue Republican, veteran, business owner, respected voice in the community. And so Madison Cawthorn will, at his young age, have a chance to regroup and come back sometime in the future. Who knows what he'll be doing then. Also, the big news coming out of Pennsylvania is that it looks like Dr. Oz, Mehmet Oz, O-Z, had that medical TV talk show for all those years. And he's a very, very wealthy man as a result of all that. He barely won, at least I should say it looks like he's clinging to a lead for the Republican nomination over more of a establishment moderate Republican. And he will likely be the Republican nominee. If he is, he's almost certainly headed to the United States Senate.
I know a lot of notoriety went to Dr. Oz, in addition to what he's kind of done with his broadcasting work, because Donald Trump endorsed him in that Republican primary. Did Oprah Winfrey endorse anybody in that primary? Because Dr. Oz kind of launched to fame because he had been a frequent guest on Oprah Winfrey shows. She was silent, right?
I don't know. You know, I've noticed that there's been a couple of spinoffs. Dr. Phil, for instance, used to be on her show all the time, and then he spun off to his own. And Oprah doesn't appear to like that.
Ah, right. And there was a black woman running in that Republican primary, too. You'd think if Oprah was going to endorse anybody, could potentially be her. But no endorsement.
Well, let us remember, Oprah is a Democrat.
I guess Oprah's busy.
And so she's probably, yes. She's probably looking for, if I were the Democratic candidate, I'd be doing everything I could to have Oprah endorse me.
Yeah, probably. That would help with most Democratic voters, I reckon.
In Idaho, the governor there, Governor Little, was being opposed by his own lieutenant governor, who is a strident supporter of President Trump, and was caught speaking to some groups that you really don't want to speak to, with racist ties and all the rest. Anyway, it was, people were wondering whether she could mount this populist crusade to take down the incumbent Republican governor. The answer is no. The governor won by over 20 percentage points. I mean, it was not even close. The most intriguing election result of the day yesterday was right next door in the state of Oregon. In the state of Oregon, they have a closed primary. Okay, you vote, you tell them whether you want a Democratic ballot or a Republican ballot going in. And the Democratic candidate for governor, the winner, the one who took the most votes in the Democratic primary, is Tina Kotek, who is an ardently liberal Portland, Oregon politician. She was also the former Oregon House Speaker. The Republicans decided to give their votes, a majority of their votes, to Christine Drazen. Christine Drazen was maintaining her lead over the head of the Oregon Republican Party. Now, Republicans have not had much luck winning the governorship in Oregon any more than they have here in Washington. But there's going to be a wild card that was not even on the ballot yesterday. A longtime Democratic state senator, Betsy Johnson, a genuine blue-collar conservative Democrat. So, again, someone like Betsy Johnson is not only not hand in glove with the Portland, Oregon set, they hate her. They see her as an infidel. Now, how dare you be a Democrat and not support Antifa and, you know, progressive legislation? Betsy Johnson actually resigned her position in the Democratic Party and filed as an independent. So she wasn't on the ballot yesterday. What she needs are petition signatures that will qualify her to be the third candidate in the race in November. Betsy Johnson is anti-tax, pro-gun rights, anti-woke, and basically she's the kind of Democrat who thinks that the far left is ruining her party. She recognizes the reality that the far left now controls the machinery of the Oregon Democratic Party. So she says, fine, I'll run as an independent. She's very blunt and straightforward. As soon as she saw the primary results, former Senator Betsy Johnson described Kotek on social media as, quote, more Kate Brown than Kate Brown. Close quote. Now, that's a comparison to the very unpopular, outgoing Democratic governor, Kate Brown. She has just historically low approval ratings. She said, the biggest change Oregon can make this year is putting the people back in charge with an independent governor loyal only to Oregonians, not the political extremes. There's a very good chance that that message is going to get traction. So you might have a completely wild, open-ended governor's race in Oregon as a result of all this. It is coming up here on 850. When we come back, couple of stories you need to know about. The first is you've already heard about the next door neighbor's two pit bulls attacking that 11-year-old girl who's going to be okay. Did you know this is the third local story in just the last week involving pit bulls? We will tell you what they are, and also the police chief of Spokane says he knows exactly who is to blame for the drug trafficking and the growing violent crime that is directly tied to it. We'll tell you who the chief is blaming.
Coverage beyond the tweets. Talk Radio 570 KVI.
Yes, we do have extra latitude for your phone calls the last hour of the show, so call me at 206-421-5757. 206-421-5757, outside King County, 888-312-5757. The police chief of Spokane, Craig Meidel, says that a massive increase in drug trafficking and violence can be tied to the Washington State Legislature. That means, by the way, one party, because one party controls the state legislature. That would be the Democrats. And of course, they couldn't get this agenda through without Jay Inslee signing it into law. So there is one party only, responsible for all this. A week after the chief made these comments, A major drug bust there in Spokane resulted in 35 pounds of methamphetamine and 50,000 fake pills that are believed to be fentanyl, which is many times more lethal than heroin. Quote, one fentanyl-laced pill can kill, so this seizure likely saved dozens, if not hundreds, of lives in the Spokane area, said the U.S. Attorney for Eastern Washington, Vanessa Waldriff. The police chief, Craig Meidel, had informed the Spokane Business Council that gang activity had increased with greater influx of drugs into the region. He says Spokane is now seeing a spike in violence and property crimes tied to the drug trafficking. However, he laid much of the blame for the increase in lawlessness at the feet of the Washington legislature. He said that policies that were passed to decriminalize drugs and curb police powers had fed a resistance to authority. He said under current law that the legislature passed, again, one party did all this. The first two times that people are caught with drugs, they used to be charged with a felony. Now, the first two times they're arrested, they're diverted to service options. The third time they are arrested with heroin or meth, they will be cited for a misdemeanor with a maximum penalty of 90 days in jail. The local prosecutor in Spokane County, Larry Haskell, said that when you now have 100,000 people dying of drug overdose deaths in, or 100,000 people dying of drug overdoses in this country, it's time to hold people more accountable, not less accountable. Chief Meidel has been in law enforcement since the mid-1990s. Said nothing in all that experience compares to what officers face on the streets today. Spokane's crime rate had been trending down for several years, but a, quote, dramatic reversal, close quote, occurred after laws to curtail police powers went into effect almost 2 years ago. The number of shootings this year in Spokane surpasses the total reported in all of 2018 and already exceeds the numbers in 2021 for the same time period. Chief Meidel went on to say that property crime in Spokane has increased by 35% over last year. That amounts to millions in losses to downtown business owners. Car thefts in Spokane are up nearly 90%. Police pursuits no longer allowed for these low-level crimes due to those bills, anti-cop bills, pushed through by Democratic lawmakers. This is all party policy. I'm not being partisan here. There were no Republican votes for this. There were nothing but Democrat votes for it. And it is resulting in a far more serious and far more dangerous society. Prosecutor Haskell said that the legislature is accomplishing a slow but methodical elimination of the Sentencing Reform Act, which was created more than 40 years ago to determine sentences based on the seriousness of the offense. He said today's legislature is more focused on treatment than accountability. You know, we have been here before. This is exactly what Olympia was doing in the 60s and 70s. Exactly what they were doing back then. And the results, well, a proliferation in crime. Before we wrap up here, want to get to Joel Moreno's great report on a chilling, terrifying story. Two pit bulls got through a hole in the owner's fence and attacked an 11-year-old girl on her porch. Have a listen.
Mariana McCraggy never imagined she'd be fending off her neighbor's two dogs, but this footage shows the American bullies lunging at her on her own front porch.
I seen a broom, so I, well, tried to fight them off with the broom, and then they bit on.
Mariana's dad says normally someone is home, but school let out early, so his 11-year-old daughter was by herself. He says the dogs like to bark, but he's never had a problem with them or their owners before.
It was just a major accident. Maybe they should have double-checked the fence, you know, before they left the dogs unattended in the backyard.
Auburn police arrived after the attack was called in. One officer had barely gotten out of his patrol car when the two loose dogs made a wild run at him. We stopped the body camera footage before the officer opened fire. The wounded dog was later euthanized. The other dog was returned to its owner.
Again, they attacked the little girl, and the minute the police arrived, they attacked the officer. In Seattle's East Lake neighborhood, right near the University Bridge, there had been another pit bull attack. Two pit bulls attacked a woman who was out on a morning walk. She is still in the hospital after multiple surgeries. Keep in mind, pit bulls, they'll just, you know, strip, they'll grab an arm, they'll grab a leg, grab whatever, and strip it straight to the bone. As for the Auburn story, a neighbor of the 11-year-old girl, not the neighbor who owns the dogs, said that they've never been a problem before.
This is the first time they ever done something like this. Or the first time they ever got out the gate. They've never posed a problem. They're always around kids.
Okay, for the 11-year-old, she was only wounded on the arm.
Mariana ended up with a bite wound on her arm. She says the whole experience was scary and isn't sure what to think about the surviving dog still being next door.
It's fine. I just don't really want that to happen again.
Okay. What to do? In Eatonville, which is close to Mount Rainier out there in Pierce County, the sheriff's department just confiscated 13 dogs, including some pit bulls. So, you know, you can only have 5 dogs on a property without getting further licensing. But what's interesting about this pit bull story, how many times have we heard this? That the pit bull was fine, and then one day, for some reason, he just launched on my neighbor, or just attacked my next door neighbor's little Yorkshire poodle. We hear that all the time. Tired of hearing stories like that. Irresponsible ownership should be punished.